Matthew 16. Matthew is a book written by a Jew, primarily two Jews, about a Jew. He is writing about the Lord. He's writing about the Messiah. He introduces the Messiah, John the Baptist. He introduces the kingdom. And Jews, of course, are turning against him. They're not accepting him. He's just not the Messiah they expected. They expected a Messiah, but not one like him, not one coming in humility and submission. They expected a conqueror to come. They expected a king to come. They expected a man of valor, a man that would take nothing from no one and would especially, as they would say, deliver them from Rome. That was the big thing on their heart, and I understand that. I'd like to have somebody come and just straighten out all the troubles of the world. But this Messiah was not the one they expected, but he was the Messiah. But he is now, beginning around chapter 13, begins to turn away from Israel. And I say this just about every week, I realize that, but I want to remind us where we're at. And he is turning to the Gentiles. He's turning away from the Jews. He's doing it slowly, but at the same time, certainly. And we want to start reading again in verse 25. Jesus says, "For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. For what is a man profitable if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then shall he reward every man according to his works." Jesus, as we mentioned last time, he talks here about those that want to save their life are the ones that should learn how to give it away. I mentioned that it's like our time, or it's like our bank accounts. The time that we have, the strength we have, the health we have, the knowledge we have, the intellect we have, all our capacity, whatever it is, and everything about our life, God has allotted to us, and we are spending that. You have spent some time today, you will not recover. And how we're spending that does matter. And Jesus said the way to find real life is not by hoarding it to yourself or saying, "I'm going to live as I please, I'm going to get what I want to get, and that way I'll be happy." He says the way to be happy, the way to find true life and true contentment is to give, but to give your life to the Lord and to sell out and to save, to commit yourself to Him. Literally to lose your life. And then he comes to a conclusion in verse 27, and he tells them why he said that. Why is it important to sell out? Why is it important to lose our life? Well, the reason is because every one of us will stand before the Lord. And he mentions a specific time when he'll do that, when he comes. Verse 27, "For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, then he shall reward every man according to his works." Now the word "for" in verse 27 connects it back to verse 25 and verse 26. So we know that he's saying this, that he is saying in this verse because of what he's already said. And he says in essence these verses, verse 25 and 26, "I told you to live for me, live for others, don't hoard yourself, don't live selfish life. I have said to give, I've said to die out to your desires because one day you'll stand before God. One day you'll stand before Him, the Son of Man," His earthly name, speaking of Jesus. "For the Son of Man shall come," we understand that. But he's not talking here about the rapture, of course. He's talking about what we call the second coming, when he would literally come to the earth. "For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father." He's going to come. Now, we know that one day Jesus will come in the rapture. That's when he meets his children. He calls up his bride. He calls us up who are saved. And we will meet him in the air. He does not come all the way to the earth at the rapture. He comes in the clouds, and he waits on us to get there. And we go to heaven with him. Let me just say this. After the rapture, of course, the great tribulation period sets up in this world. And for 7 years, there'll be misery. There'll be death. There'll be heartache. There'll be sin. There'll be selfishness for 7 years. There'll be literally more trouble on this earth than it has ever seen. At the end of that seven-year period, Jesus comes back again. He comes back again with his angels and with us. And this time, he will come literally all the way to the earth. And that's what it's talking about here. When he comes the second time, not the rapture, but the second time. And he comes with glory. Notice what it says. It says right there, the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father and his angels, and then he shall reward every man according to his works. When he comes the second time, he'll not come in humility. That's one of the reasons why the Jews struggled with thinking that Jesus was the Messiah. He came in humility. He came giving. He came in an humble or a meek spirit. But the next time he comes, he will not come in humility. He'll come with power and glory. The first time they rejected him, the first time they resisted him, but the next time they'll not. They'll get what they've got coming. He came the first time in humility. He'll come the second time in power. He came the first time giving and doing and sacrificing and even being crucified. But the second time he'll come and he will make his kingdom. He will sit on the throne. He will come to rule and to reign. The second coming will be quite a bit different than the first coming. And that's what we want to try to look at for a little while this evening. He talks about how he's going to come. And then when he talks about, notice what it says, for the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father. The glory of his Father. What in the world does that mean? Does that mean just a big shining light? Well, sort of and sort of not. The glory, when you see the word glory of the Father or glory of God, listen closely, it's talking about the full manifestation of God, of seeing him as he really is. I thought about this. It astounds me to even think about it. Seeing God as he really is. We haven't yet, and I'm glad we haven't, because if we had, we would have died. None of us could stand in the presence of God. None of us could look on him. We'd be consumed like a moth in a candle. But when we see him as he is, we'll see him as the God of heaven. The glory is a fact of us seeing him being manifested as he is in all his attributes, and seeing his holiness, and seeing his purity, and seeing his power, and seeing his omniscience, seeing him as he is. And the Bible says that when Jesus comes back, he will be in that glory, or he will manifest that glory. I tried to kind of ponder what that'll be like. It's beyond my little mind, I promise you. Remember, Jesus comes back and we are with him. The saints are with him, but the angels are with him. And when he comes back, the angels go and do his deeds. They round up people. There's no doubt about that. He deals with the Antichrist and the tribulation period. There's a lot of stuff going on. But the angels at one time, all of them will gather around him. And he will be the focal point. I can't imagine what that would be like. I thought about, well, there's probably billions of angels we don't really know. But you think about the choir of angels manifesting him and putting him in the focus and him being as he is. Boy, I can't imagine what it's going to be like, but I'm glad I'll get to see it then. But one of the things he'll do, he will judge people. Notice what it says again in verse 27. With his angels, and he shall reward every man according to his works. He will reward every man according to his works. Now, I've got a question. Does that mean we are judged by what we do and our works? And if we have more good works than bad works, we go to heaven? Or if we have more bad works than good works, we go to hell? Is that what that means? Well, of course not. But it does mean that God will use works in a way of discerning what people are. Jesus said this, "By their fruits ye shall know them." What he's saying is, as a righteous person does righteous things. In other words, a saved person does things that look like a saved person. And an unrighteous man or woman does unrighteous things. So he, in essence, knows, I can judge them by what they did and determine what they were. If they're saved, it's going to show itself. If they knew me when they walked this earth, it will reveal itself. I can watch what they did and determine who they were. And that's exactly what he's going to do. He will use their works to determine whether they go to heaven or hell. Now, of course, the thing is their heart, whether they really were saved or not. But he says, I'm going to use their works to determine their rewards in heaven or their punishment in hell. No wonder Jesus said, you better give your life to me. And if you're in this world, the best thing you can do is sell out. Don't hold on to your life. Don't live selfish. Live for me. Live godly while you can, because one day you'll stand before me. Again, here's these people who are standing before the Lord. They've lived through the tribulation period already. And some have gotten saved, there's no doubt. Jesus rewards them by letting them go into the millennial reign and later on go to heaven. There's some that have come through the tribulation period. There's lost as goose, as geese or whatever. They're lost. They don't know him, and their lifestyle proves it. Hear me. During the tribulation period, the lifestyle of a person will prove whether they're lost or not more than ever, because it will be so tough and so hard. If somebody's not saved, they're not going to live like it. If somebody's lost, you're going to know it. And if somebody's saved, you're going to know it. So they'll be judged by their works and, of course, by their heart, whether they were really saved or not. The lost go into hell later on to go to the lake of fire. They're saved going through the millennium. And Jesus says that he'll give rewards. There'll be some. Remember the parable where it says you'll be a ruler over 10 cities? And you'll be a ruler over 5 cities. These folks will come into the millennial, go into the millennial reign and have rewards during that 1,000 years when Jesus lives, rules, and reigns in this world. Lost people who've lived for themselves will be put to death, will go to hell, and they'll suffer for eternity. Saved people who have suffered terribly during the tribulation period will be blessed and honored by the blessings of God's rewards, and later on a glorified body and a home in heaven. He says, make sure you do now what you'll be glad you did. Now, I'm sure that as these disciples heard what he's saying, remember he's talking to his disciples. I'm sure what he said confused them, because they are thinking about a Messiah that's going to deliver them right now, and he's not even talking about that at all. He's talking about something in the future. And there's no doubt that what they were hearing confused them. There's no doubt they wondered, what in the world is he talking about? But I believe also it comforted them. Because they realized when they heard what he was saying, he is the Messiah. Now, what he's saying right now, we can't grasp it all. What he's saying right now is contrary to what we have thought was going to happen. But we do realize that by what he's saying, we know that we're not crazy. There is a Messiah coming, and he is the one. Look in verse 28. I got to hurry up. I'm going to get where I'm going. Verily I say unto you, there be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. He said to His disciples, there's some that are standing here that will not taste of death before they see Him coming in His glory. Now, who's He talking about? Well, He's talking about some of them. That's all I can tell you. The who is not as near as difficult as the what. Notice again, there shall be some there be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. Now you're gonna have to listen closely. What's He talking about? He said, some of you won't die before you see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. Well, there's some ideas. There's some opinions. Some say that He was talking about Pentecost, second chapter of Acts, when the Holy Spirit came and, if you will, birthed the church. And they say that's what He was talking about when He's talking about His kingdom. Well, I have problems with that. Number one, Jesus didn't come. The Son of Man didn't come. The Holy Spirit did. Some say what He's talking about here in verse 28 is not the church, but it's the destruction of Jerusalem. In 70 A.D., Titus came into Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, pretty much destroyed Jerusalem, killed a lot of Jews. And what they say is Jesus is saying here that He's going to come and judge people, judge the Jews. And the Jews didn't get judged in 70 A.D. I mean, listen, it's a focal point in Jewish heritage. It's a milestone in Jewish heritage about 70 A.D. when Titus came and destroyed everything. I mean, it wrecked everything. But Jesus didn't come in 70 A.D. Titus did. Some say that what Jesus is talking about here in verse 28, now you're going to have to listen. It's simple, but it's a little bit you have to listen. What He's saying in verse 28 is John the Beloved, when he was having the vision that ended up being the book of Revelation. Remember, John saw the kingdom, and he saw the tribulation period, and he wrote it down. But the problem with that was Jesus said, some will not taste death. So John's only one man. So there's another opinion, and it's my opinion. It's not without issues, but some say what Jesus is talking about in verse 28 is the transfiguration. The next verse, chapter 17, verse 1, starts about where Jesus is going to be transfigured before Peter, James, and John. And I believe what Jesus is talking about in verse 28 is the fact that you're going to see a preview of the kingdom. You're going to see a preview. Now notice what He says. Some standing here shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. And I believe simply what He's saying is there's coming a time, and it won't be long, you'll still be alive, that you'll see the Son of Man in His kingdom. Now, my opinion is, and I'm surely not alone, is that He's talking about the transfiguration. Let's go on in chapter 17 and look at that and try and see if we can cover some territory. It's a preview of the kingdom. Now remember, the kingdom is when Jesus comes and sets up His kingdom, His throne, and He rules with power. And He's about to show a preview of that. Chapter 17, beginning in verse 1, the king's manifestation. Jesus is transfigured. Look in verse 1. And after six days after their conversation that we just read about in chapter 16. After 6 days, Peter, James, and John, his brother, bringeth them up. Let me start over. And after 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, and bringeth them up into a high mountain apart. So after 6 days, now there's a little issue. I'll go ahead and throw this in. It's in your notes that I'll get to you sooner or later. Luke says after 8 days. Matthew and Mark says after 6 days. Is that a contradiction? Did the Bible mess up? Were they wrong? Well, of course not. simple fact is Jesus' conversation in verse 28 happened on one day. 6 days later, the transfiguration happened on another day. So there's 6 days in between them. By the way, also Mark says about 8 days. So it's just simply their different viewpoint of how many days it was. Mark's not trying to pinpoint exactly how long it was. He just says about 8 days. So there's no contradiction. When you get your notes, you can look through that and go through it in more detail right now. I'd rather just mention that and keep on going. Peter, James, and John, Jesus brings with him, and they go to a high mountain apart. Peter, James, and John were not his favorites, but he did use them in specific ways. They would later on to go to Gethsemane with him. The other disciples, if you will, were left behind. We find that happening here. Peter, James, and John, no doubt, seem to be the closest of the 12. And John, of those three, is closer than any of the others. Again, it's not that Jesus has favorites or he is a respecter person. It just means he uses different people in different ways. And there's no doubt, I believe we can say this, those men were closer than the others. I just think that's true. So they go to a mountain. Luke tells us that they go to this mountain and Jesus is praying. And when he's praying, he's transfigured before them. Kind of helps me realize how beneficial prayer can be and how much we need to pray. He's transfigured. It literally means to be transformed. Now, that does not mean that Jesus was changed. What it means is the appearance that they saw was different. It was like, for a moment, Jesus' flesh was rolled back. When Jesus walked this earth, his flesh covered up his godliness, his godness. He was God in flesh, and the flesh obscured the view of God. On the Transfiguration, on the Mount of Transfiguration, that flesh was, as if it was kind of opened up or moved back or disappeared for a moment. And the real God inside was seen. I would have loved to have been there and seen that, by the way. But strange thing about it is Luke not only tells us that Jesus was praying when he became transfigured, but guess what the disciples were doing? They were sleeping. Hey, they slept so much. They slept in Gethsemane, if you remember. And the Bible does sort of take up for them just a little bit, because it talks about in Mark, I believe it is, that they were heavy with sleep. It means that their hearts were so heavy. Remember, they've been told, Jesus tells them that I'm going to die. They didn't want to hear that. That's the last thing they understood. They were trying to comprehend all this new news. And their hearts are heavy. Have you ever really been depressed? Have you ever really had something heavy on you? You know what you want to do? Sleep. And that's part of why they're sleeping. They're worn out physically for one reason, but they're heavy because of the news of him going to die, and they can't contemplate it. They can't understand it. So they're sleeping. Now, that does not excuse them, but at least it explains a little bit about why they're asleep. So Jesus is praying. He's transfigured. They're asleep. They wake up and see him. Look in verse 2. And was transfigured before them, and his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was as white as the light. Transfigured again means to be transformed. It means that his flesh somehow disappeared, moved away. He let them see him as he really is, and his face did shine as the sun, literally as a noonday sun. How long has it been since you tried looking at the sun? You can't. His face was as bright as the noonday sun. And his clothing, the Bible uses the word glistening or glycerin. It means it glowed. It literally means, I'm convinced, to look at him, you couldn't keep your eyes on him. You know what that is? That's Him. That's God. They were being able to see a little bit of God. It says His raiment was as white as the light. I thought about this. The Hollywood stars, they got those spotlights that shine on them. They shine and glisten. They had to have an outside source to make them glisten. His source was inside. He didn't need a spotlight. He was the spotlight. Look at verse 3. Behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elias talking with Him. So all of a sudden, here's Moses and Elijah. Well, why are they here? Well, they're Old Testament people. Moses is the law. He wrote the first five books of the Bible. Elijah is the prophet, so he's the Old Testament. The Bible literally calls them Moses and the prophets. They represent the Old Testament. And that's very important that we realize that. And it talks about in Luke that he even tells what Moses and Elijah and Jesus is talking about. They're talking about His demise or His departure, His death. It tells me that the death of Christ wasn't a surprise. Moses and Elijah in heaven already knew about the fact that Jesus was going to die, and they're talking about that. It reassures me that the Bible is correct and what happened wasn't an accident or wasn't a surprise. Some have said, well, how did Peter, James, and John know Moses and Elijah? And I think, well, that's easy. God let them know. When we get to heaven, we'll know everybody. One thing for sure, I'll know you like you know me. We surely ain't going to be dumber in heaven than we are here. If I know you now, surely we'll know you then. But we'll know everybody. I'm convinced about that. Look at verse 4. Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If Thou will, let us make three tabernacles, one for Thee, one for Moses, and one for Elias. Well, like usual, Peter says the wrong thing at the wrong time. He says, man, this is so good, I don't want to leave. And I don't blame him. I wouldn't either. But the problem was, it wasn't time to hang around on the mountain. It was time to go back down and work. It was time to go back down and Jesus do what the Father had sent Him to do. Peter said, let us build three tabernacles. It literally means tents. It means booths, like the feast of the tabernacles that the Jews had. They would literally build a little temporary booth that they would stay in for a few days. And Peter's just simply saying, let's just stay right here. Let's don't leave. This is too good to leave behind. And even though that sounds good, it wasn't what the Lord wanted to do at that time. Without thinking, Peter said something and didn't realize it. One of the writers says that Peter said it not knowing what he was saying. Also says that Peter said it out of fear. You ever been afraid? And something just come out of your mouth? Have you ever just said something when you really didn't even think about what you were saying? Well, that's kind of like what Peter was that day. He said something when he should have just kept his mouth shut, but that's not new for Peter. We need to realize, though, that Peter didn't know what was happening. I'm going to try and get through these verses, so hang on a little bit. I know this is difficult tonight. It really is. It's not easy, but it's Bible, so we'll trudge through. Peter didn't realize what was going on. Peter's thinking, he's been taught all his life that there's a man coming that's going to be the king, and he's going to set up his kingdom, and he's going to rule and reign, and that's still what's in his mind. And he knows that this king will be a mighty king, a glorious king, and he also knows that the Old Testament prophets and the Old Testament people will be a part of this kingdom. And here he is, Jesus is manifested before him. He sees Jesus as he is, and here's Moses, and here's Elijah. Peter, I'm convinced, thinks, man, this is it. This is the beginning of the kingdom. This is the start of it all. And no wonder he says, let's just stay here for a while. I believe he really thought that Jesus was just about to set up the kingdom. And I understand that. The only problem is he's wrong. Jesus has just told him, few days before, some of you won't die till you see, before you see me coming in my kingdom. So that seems to fit. And Jesus' glory is revealed before them, and he knows enough to know that the Messiah is going to be a mighty person and glorious. And Moses and Elijah are present, so he knows that Israel is going to be restored, and God's people, the Jews, will be restored. So he's thinking, man, we've got to make now. It's starting. Another problem that we've got with Peter, though, is he says, let us build three tabernacles for Jesus, for Moses, and Elijah. He's putting the three on the same level. You don't ever do that with Jesus. Look on verse 5. When he had spake, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. Behold, out of the voice of the cloud, and which said, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him. While this is going on, a cloud comes down, and it literally means it engulfs them. A bright cloud engulfed them. And from heaven there's a voice. Wonder who said this. Behold, it says, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him. I guess we know who it is. The Father speaks to these disciples and said, this is my Son. I'm pleased with him. Now you listen to him. It's not the first time they heard this voice, but every time this voice speaks from heaven to these people, these New Testament people, he says the same thing. This is my Son. Listen to him. I think that's what he says tonight too. This is my Son. Listen to him. It's amazing to just imagine what it was like. Look in verse 6. And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their faces and were sore afraid. Now, I don't know how to take that. When they saw Jesus manifested in his transfiguration and his glory, they were overwhelmed. But when they heard the voice of heaven, they weren't just overwhelmed. They fell on their face. The voice of God has an effect on people. They fell on their face, and they were sore afraid. Verse 7, Jesus came and touched them and said, arise, be ye not afraid. Jesus comes and touches them. He has compassion on them. It's amazing what the touch of the Lord can do, by the way. He said, arise. It's not time to sit down now. Kind of like Joshua when he's praying. And God said, get up off your knees. Get up on, and it's time to do something. First thing he said to these, arise. And then he said, be not afraid. Don't fear. We can trust him no matter what. No matter what we're going through. Fear can control us if we let it. But Jesus, no matter what our circumstances, says, you don't have to be afraid. You can trust me. Verse 8, and when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no man save Jesus only. When they went down, their eyes went down. Probably they closed their eyes. When they looked back up, Jesus is talking to them, and only Jesus is there, and he's back to his earthly, human, physical body. It was an experience that I would have loved to have gone through. I would have loved to imagine what it would be like, but these disciples, one thing for sure, they never did forget it. Peter later on said, we were eyewitnesses of his glory. Remember that? He said, we were eyewitnesses, and he points to this thing of the transfiguration. It says, the Son, in verse 9, and as they came down from the mountain, Jesus charged them, saying, tell the vision to no man until the Son of Man be risen from the dead. This is one of those commandments you don't want to hear. You imagine being a witness to the transfigurated Christ. Moses and Elijah are there talking to you. And Jesus says, don't tell anybody. The first thing you'd want to do is go back down that mountain and say, hey, buddies, guess what happened to us? But he said, don't do it. You know what? They didn't do it. Luke tells us they did not do it until after the resurrection. They were eyewitnesses. Now, real quickly, all this is a picture of the millennial reign, the kingdom. Why do we say that, number one? And I know you love to hear number one this late in the message. The Messiah was the center of attention on the Mount of Transfiguration. Moses and Elijah was there, and the three disciples were there. But who was the focus? Who was the focus on? Jesus was. During the millennial reign, the Messiah will have the attention. The focus will be on him. The second thing about that experience on the Mount of Transfiguration that makes us realize it's a preview of the kingdom is the Messiah had come to a mountain. Again, Zechariah said that his feet will come down and touch the Mount of Olives, and the Mount of Olives will split. At the second coming, Jesus will literally come to the earth, and he will touch down and walk on the earth. And that's exactly what happened to the Mount of Transfiguration. He went to a mountain, because this is a preview of his millennial reign of the kingdom. The third thing, the Messiah will gather his people together. One of the first things he does is gather his people together when he comes back the second time to set up his kingdom. And that's exactly what's going on there. Moses and Elijah and the three disciples, Old Testament, New Testament. I could go so far to say Moses died, Elijah didn't. Some will go into the tribulation period alive. Some will be in the rapture, and I know that confuses you even more. But the people that are there represent those that will be in the kingdom. The next thing, some of those who enter the kingdom will have died. Some will die during the tribulation period and ascend to heaven. When he comes back in the second coming, they'll come with him. And they'll go into the millennial. They have already died. Some will live to the end of the tribulation period, still survive the experience. They'll go into the millennial, still alive in their normal bodies. I know this is a lot to get. I know that. But I've got to chunk it out so we can go on. Some will enter the kingdom in their natural bodies. Elijah didn't die. He went to heaven in a whirlwind on his chariot. So we find here, and I'm going to wrap it up. I know I've probably stirred up more questions and confusion than anything else tonight, because it's not easy to deal with. But Jesus revealed himself, manifested himself. I am convinced he did it to show them and us that one day this will happen. He will come to this earth. He will go to Jerusalem. He will sit on a throne. He will sit in the throne of David. He will rule and reign, and we'll be here. What capacity? I don't know. We'll find out then. The Jews will be here. What capacity? I don't know for sure. We'll find out then.